Hey everyone, and welcome to the Five Bytes Podcast. I'm your host, Rory Monahan. Coming up on this week's episode, a vulnerability with a 10 out of 10 on the severity scale that affects Linux tools and libraries has been disclosed. Also, Google and Microsoft make sweeping changes off the back of scorn by regulators, and Microsoft has published pricing details for Windows 10 extended security updates. To hear about this and more, keep listening to this episode of the podcast, which, as always, is brought to you by my sponsors, and that includes ControlUp, Networks Policy Pack, and Numescent. As always, if you enjoy the show each week, you have these awesome sponsors to thank. And now for some news. Red Hat has warned users to immediately stop using systems running Fedora development and experimental versions because of a backdoor found in the latest Zed Utilities data compression tools and libraries. This is after reports and evidence of the injection successfully building in XZ 5.6.x versions built for Debian's unstable SID version are other distributions that may also be affected, but they state that no versions of Red Hat Enterprise Linux or RHEL are affected. Debian's security team also issued an advisory warning users about the issue. The advisory says that no stable Debian versions are using the compromised packages and that the XZ has been reverted to the upstream 5.4.5 code on affected Debian testing, unstable, and experimental distributions. Kali Linux, OpenSUSE, and Arch Linux have also published security advisories of their own and reversed versions in affected rolling releases. I guess the good news here is it seems like it's predominantly affecting those like developmental, unstable testing type of versions. So hopefully this isn't going to be impacting on like production systems. Administrators can check which version of XZ is installed by querying with their package manager or by running a shell script that has been shared by cybersecurity researchers at Costis. Microsoft software engineer Andreas Freund discovered the security issue while investigating slow SSH logins on a Linux box running Debian SID. Red Hat is now tracking this supply chain security issue as CVE-2024-3094, and it's been assigned a 10 out of 10 on the critical severity score. And as stated, the versions have been reverted in those test versions of the various different distributions that were affected. And rather concerning is the fact that this is a supply chain security issue, and at the moment, an exact purpose for the malicious code that was added to this library for the data compression has not been found. So I feel like this story is probably going to have legs too. Now, luckily, it was only in those kind of test development versions, but in Linux environments, those could be used pretty heavily by developers. So it's possible that someone already had their hands in the cookie jar and got some goodies out of this. The US CISA has also published an advisory of their own warning developers to downgrade to an uncompromised XE version. So we'll just have to watch this space to see how this story develops in the coming weeks and months. It seems the mystery of how much Windows 10 extended security updates is a mystery no more. It seems the mystery of how much Windows 10 extended security updates will cost is a mystery no more. Microsoft has published details on pricing and also different paths that customers can take to receive discounts or in some cases free ESUs. If using Windows 10 desktops with traditional licensing models, the base price is $61 per desktop for year one. If you use a cloud-based management solution, which really means Intune or AutoPatch, you can get a 25% discount, bringing the cost to $45 per user rather than per device for year one. And that is up to 5 devices, so it seems like 25%, but the way I read it or interpret it, it could be significantly greater cost savings. Then, if you leverage Windows 365 for your Windows 11 rollout and connect via a Windows 10 machine as your client, you can get free ESUs for the Windows 10 client devices as long as you give a one-year commitment for Windows 365 use. The good news is that education customers can get the ESUs for as low as $1. As with Windows 7 ESUs, the price doubles for each additional year, and the ESUs will only be offered for 3 years. For education, the price goes up to $2 in the second year and then $4 in the final third year, which is not too bad. But imagine having to pay over $180 per desktop as a non-education customer in that third year. Yikes. For me, the announcement coming now is good because the skeptic in me had worried and thought that Microsoft may wait until about 18 months or less until end of support for Windows 10 to announce this, which would put pressure for those who had yet to start migrating because they'd see this sticker shock and go, oh my God, we have to start migrating right now, and it would already be too late to start that planning. I also have concerns with the way that Microsoft has dangled carrots here though. In the past, for server operating systems going end of support, they were offering ESUs for those who moved their workloads to Azure. Now with these ESUs, they are providing free ESUs to those who commit to at least a year of Windows 365 and discounts to those who use AutoPatch or Intune. These feel like something regulators should be jumping all over, as obviously the licensing and the extended security updates for the operating systems is something that only Microsoft can offer. So by offering these for free or at heavily discounted prices for using other Microsoft services, that is an advantage that no other competitor can leverage because it's simply not available to them. This week's episode, I'm going to be covering a lot about regulators. So this is just the beginning of that. Strap in. On a previous episode of the podcast, I covered a story about claims that Google was collecting user data even when using incognito mode. Well, now Google has struck a deal with the US government to resolve a class action lawsuit brought in 2020, which had accused Google of collecting said user data even when they were browsing in this private mode, quote unquote. As part of the deal, Google has agreed to delete billions of records and submit to some restrictions on its power to track users under the terms of a proposed legal settlement. While the class action lawsuit was taken in the US, Google will be deleting records for users outside of the US too. The BBC reports in the US, Google and its parent company Alphabet are facing two separate monopoly cases brought by the federal government. It has also recently settled a number of other suits. It paid nearly $400 million in 2022 to settle claims brought by U.S. states that it tracked the location of users who had opted out of location services on their devices, and in December 2023, it also agreed to a $700 million settlement to resolve a lawsuit brought by a group of U.S. states that had accused it of quashing competition to its Play Store on Android devices. Also in a previous episode of the podcast, I covered the fact that European regulators were working a case brought by Slack and others a few years ago that claimed Microsoft had an unfair advantage in the market by offering Teams via Office 365. Interestingly, Microsoft will now be removing Teams from the Office suite globally, so not just within Europe, but globally. So, in the previous story, Google is making a change globally after a US regulator cracked down on them. In this instance, Microsoft is making a global change after the European regulators were cracking down on them. Now, nowhere have I read this, but I wonder if the FTC in the US and the European Commission in Europe may be working in closer tandem when it comes to regulations on these tech companies now. And perhaps they're threatening to bring the same cases in their jurisdiction after one has been resolved in the other jurisdiction. If so, I say bravo. I know not all people will be for regulation, and there are those that have this kind of philosophy of, well, just let the companies do what they do and let the chips fall where they may. But in a week when there's actually been quite a lot of mainstream coverage around AI in particular, and the dangers of having that being completely unregulated and allowing the largest companies to acquire startups to propel themselves to the front of this AI revolution. It's a really interesting time, and I think it just kind of further highlights the need for strict regulations and for keeping these larger companies in check. So yeah, I say kudos. And really, it's about time, because I feel like the reins should have been placed on some of these tech companies years ago. The president of Broadcom Software for Asia Pacific reportedly told The Register that complaints about higher prices are unwarranted since customers who are using at least two components of VMware's flagship cloud foundation will end up paying less. And because the new pricing includes support, which VMware didn't include before, since they've announced these changes to the licensing cost of their products. The Register also reported that several VPs in various divisions of VMware agreed that people who think moving to subscriptions is unfair are not considering that VMware waited longer than many in the industry to implement the model. So I'm referencing an Ars Technica article, and they're referencing what an individual had said to the Register. But even so, it kind of reads like they're saying this maybe off the record. They don't think it's going to be published, because otherwise it just completely lacks self-awareness and understanding of how their enterprise customers operate and how budgeting is handled. Like, it sounds like they think that the reaction and customers being upset by the pricing increase is like unwarranted and it's not rational. Like, who cares if they were one of the last to move to this kind of model? It doesn't matter. They're in a position where the vast majority of enterprises out there, at least the medium to large size enterprises, are relying on their products for their infrastructure. They have a captive audience and they've turned the screw and they've increased the pricing. I mean, it's similar to Citrix. You know, Citrix for years have been like, oh, 98% of the Forbes 500 use Citrix. So they know they have that captive audience of very, very large customers that they can turn the screw on. And it concerns me that for VMware and for Citrix being owned by TIBCO and Broadcom, or, you know, the Cloud Software Group, as it's now called for Citrix, that they may just be squeezing the life out of the customers and draining as much money as possible in a short amount of time with no vision on actually like growing their customer base in the future. I feel like Citrix were at least smart enough to watch their P's and Q's. You know, they're not out here chatting with outlets and downplaying concerns of customers. And also, Citrix has a little bit of an advantage because that acquisition was completed much longer ago, like earlier than the VMware acquisition. So there's a little room between the acquisition and now. And Citrix have been able to follow through on some of their promises by investing in development and announcing new features in their core products, whereas VMware has kind of yet to step up since the acquisition, and all they're doing is talking and downplaying concerns. It's a really bad look, a really bad move, and as a VMware customer, I'd be more irked by this than anything. According to bleepycomputer.com, a new out-of-bounds read weakness has been discovered in our old friend, the Google Chrome VA JavaScript engine. This vulnerability is tracked as C2024-3159. This particular vulnerability was exploited by researchers during a hackathon where attackers could exploit the vulnerability using crafted HTML pages to gain access to data beyond the memory buffer via heap corruption, which can provide them with sensitive information or trigger a crash. This is fixed in the Google Chrome stable version 123.0.6312.105, 0.106, and 0.107 for Windows and Mac, or 0.105 for Linux, which will roll out worldwide over the coming days. It was nice that this one was exposed publicly so that information was out there, as Google tends to keep information away from the public when it's been disclosed directly to them, maybe through a bug bounty program or something that their own team has discovered. So this one actually was a nice change of pace. And during the hackathon, I believe they were actually crashing the browser. So I believe this is also the fourth zero-day vulnerability in Chrome this year. So fourth month, 4 zero-days. Greggs in the UK, which is a popular bakery, widely known by Gen Z due to TikTok infamy for their sausage rolls, which are shite in my opinion, not that you asked, but they suffered an outage that saw some branches closed or only able to accept cash on Wednesday morning last week. A little similar to what happened to McDonald's recently, and it was something I covered on a previous episode of the podcast. I guess something similar also happened to a UK grocery store chain called Sainsbury's, too. And all of these happening in relatively quick succession has led to wild speculation that they could be linked. Of course, if you listened to that previous episode of the podcast, when I covered the McDonald's outages and problems, they claimed that that was caused by a change made by a third-party vendor. So in that case, their issues would have been unintentional. Either that or McDonald's lied if what's being implied here is true, that they're linked. I'm kind of going to lean towards it not being linked. I don't know why. In an episode when I was talking about putting the reins on large tech companies, for some reason, I'm choosing to give McDonald's the benefit of the doubt and believe that this large corporate clown is telling the truth. Infoworld.com published an article about a company called OpenTofu, who made it a mission to become an open source successor to the MPL version 2 license Terraform after Terraform announced their licensing changes last summer. It is reported that in trying to keep an open source version available, OpenTofu may have illegally taken HashiCorp's code while trying to keep pace. It makes me think of the show Arrested Development with Jeffrey Tambor's character when he said, I may have committed some light treason. Well, in this instance, OpenTofu may have committed a little light copyright infringement. OpenTofu appears to have lifted Terraform code related to a new removed block feature first implemented in Terraform version 1.7, which was released under the business software license that the company switched to last summer. And apparently the tell that OpenTofu essentially just lifted this potentially copyrighted code was that this code for removing the headers was also put in OpenTofu's code base under the MPL license. There has been an attempt to excuse this away, but it is not very convincing in my opinion. And as this article suggests, it is understandable to be upset by the new license model used by HashiCorp that was announced last summer. But it is what it is. You can't just go and lift their licensed code and then claim it as open source because you say so. So it is admirable that they're trying to have this open source alternative, but they're doing it the wrong way, in my opinion, if they're just lifting code that's been put into the product after it was put under this less open licensing model. Okay, wrapping up the news for this week with some quick hit stories. First, Canva acquired the Affinity suite of creative software that's popular with Mac users, securing its biggest acquisition to date, according to Yahoo. Affinity's portfolio of photo editing, publishing, and illustration software could potentially put Canva closer to its main competitor in the space, which would be Adobe. So I guess they're nipping at the heels of Adobe, which should be good for driving innovation and also good for driving cost for customers. Nerdio Manager for Enterprise version 6 has been released, and some of the features listed in the release notes includes Azure Stack HCI auto-scaling support is now in public preview, there's been some API enhancements, an optional user control for auto-scale is included, Cloud PC frontline policy creation and management is included, support for app attach version 2 packages and remote app scenarios is included, and there's much more. And I'll share a link to the release notes with this episode if you want to read all about it. And that will be with episode 328 at 5bytespodcast.com. According to bleepycomputer.com, Google is notifying users that as of April 2nd, which has already passed by the time I recorded this episode, they will no longer be able to use Google Podcasts and is recommending them to export subscriptions to YouTube Music instead. So just another example of Google killing off one of its products. Aaron Parker has announced an update to the Evergreen App Tracker, which should result in enhanced speeds. So if you're using this, you'll be happy with the latest release. And finally, techscene.eu has reported that OpenAI has made its basic version of ChatGPT accessible to everyone without the need to create an account. However, you should know that this version is more limited in functionality than if you were to use an actual account. But now on to this episode's scripts, tricks, and tips. First up, I had actually tweeted about an issue that I was having with my Windows 11 machine, where some of my external monitors would just drop and refuse to reconnect. And the only way that I could fix it was to go into the actual settings, flip it from just internal monitor to internal plus external monitors again. I forget what the verbiage is on the actual menu, but the only thing I could do was to change this setting within the OS again. But credit to Daniel on Twitter for sharing this tip from Jen Gentleman, which is if you hit Win plus Control plus Shift plus B, that will tell your computer that you're experiencing a black screen and it will try to fix it. I had no idea that this keyboard shortcut was out there. I have not had the issue since finding out about this tip, so I haven't been able to try it out for myself. My issue seemed to happen twice since Patch Tuesday, so I'm thinking it might be Windows Update related, but I guess it may not be, or maybe it's specific to my monitors or my hardware. But whatever, this is a great tip that you may want to know about. Next up, the awesome Aaron Parker had a blog post about if you're removing Active Directory or attempting to move away from Active Directory completely, there are some things that you should consider first. And it's a really detailed, awesome blog post on why you may want to think about keeping Active Directory in place in some fashion going forward, and what you need to consider if you're planning to move away. I came across a blog post by Martin Bengtsson. I'm sorry if I butchered your name, buddy. But it's on reducing your attack service by disabling NetBIOS using PowerShell and Microsoft Intune. And he provides two scripts, one for detection and one for remediation, to disable the NetBIOS. So if you're not familiar with Intune, it has its proactive remediation feature, where you can run a script to do detection. And then if you detect something in a certain state, it can run the remediation script to set it to the correct state. So it's an interesting use of that feature. Finally, just to plug a little bit of my own work, I started a video series a couple of months ago called The Office of the Technologist. And in the first official episode, I went through a topic that I really care about, which is AppV. Well, a new episode of that video series is out, where I talk about extending DevOps capabilities to the management of Windows desktop applications. So for many years, obviously developers and infrastructure teams have been leveraging containers to overcome limitations and challenges in like scaling infrastructure to meet elastic demand. So, you know, a big example of that would be Facebook. You know, they actually apparently designed their own container format and their own container orchestration to elastically scale the service as demand increased from the users. And then web developers also have been using containers for testing their products before pushing them to production. This is a big benefit for developers because there used to be the old problem of, oh, they ship a product, it did not work at all once it was shipped. People started to complain and they just go, oh, well, it worked on my machine. And it was because they had some prerequisite or some configuration specific to their development machine that was not going to be in place on the actual end user devices. So they've been using containers to have consistency. And, you know, once that container is consumed by someone on a different machine, it's going to be consistent because everything the application requires is within that container. So those are just two examples of various different teams or disciplines within technology who have been leveraging containers. So in this video, I talk a little bit about how containers could be used for overcoming some of the challenges on the typical Windows desktop. So yeah, if you're interested to hear more about that, check out that video and I'll share a link with this episode, which again is episode 328, and you'll find that at 5bytespodcast.com. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, you'll find a link to that within the YouTube description as well. Well, that's it for this episode of the podcast.